are starting a new series that we're going to be in for the month of August. It's a series through the book of Judges. So if you have a Bible, you can turn there. If not, the words will magically appear on the screen. We're going to be in Judges chapter 3 this morning. Let's pray one more time. God, we celebrate you because you are good. And one of the reasons that we know that you are good is because somehow you see beauty in the things about ourselves that we believe to be ugly, that you see somehow in our weakness, strength, in our inability, you find ability. And we thank you for being a God who is good at that. I pray this in your name. Amen. So, earlier this week, it's about 9:45, 10 o'clock. Been gone for a little while. I walk into our kitchen and I'm overlooking the living room where my wife is sitting on the couch. And I'm shocked what I find. She's sitting on the couch and she's watching QVC eating Sun Chips. Now that's a moment too good for me to pass up. So I stop and before I even say a word, I can't even formulate an actual word. I just utter something like, And before I can even turn that into a word, she turns to me and says, Luke, stop judging me. That's all she says. Stop judging me. And the funny thing is, in that exact same scenario, Lindsay on the couch, me in the living room, 2 days before, those exact same words were uttered from the other end. I was in the kitchen, and I had a bowl, and there were three lightly cooked turtle cookies, you know, the kind with chocolate chips and caramel and walnuts on it. And they were covered in a portion of ice cream. Some might say it was a generous portion, but I just think it was a portion. And I'm standing there with this beautiful culinary treat in my hands. And Lindsay turns and looks at me and goes, well, I guess this is your cheat day. And I look at her and I say, stop judging me. We don't like to be judged. No one likes the feeling of someone judging them. It doesn't fit in our cultural feel. Like that, our culture doesn't accept that. And so you hear all the time people saying, don't judge me. Whether you're listening to Miley Cyrus, who's telling all the ladies who are shaking it, remember, only God can judge us. Or you're listening to the rapper Tupac Shakur, who is rapping, only God can judge me. Though if you're a fan of rap, you remember there was a gentleman at the front of a courtroom who sentenced Tupac to jail. So there might be some debate over how accurate that statement is. Now, since someone brought up rap already, let's go ahead and talk about something that happened 2 years ago in New York. Now, let me introduce you to two people. On the screen, we have on the left is Peter Rosenberg. You might know him as the morning host for New York's 97... Wait, what is the name of the radio station? Anyone know that? It's Hot 97. That's it. There we go. And he is the morning DJ for the most prominent, what many people believe, the most prominent hip-hop station in all the world. Okay, as you all know, hip-hop was created in Harlem, so New York's rap station is the most prominent one. He is the host of the morning show. And the lady on the right, anyone know who that is? There we go. There we go. We got a Nicki Minaj fan. She's going to like this a little bit right here. Okay, so Nicki Minaj on the right. Now, in 2012, there was a big hip-hop concert that his radio station puts on. And he was on the smaller stage before the headliner came on. And the headliner was, guess who? Nicki Minaj. And so he's on the stage. And he looks out at the crowd and says, all of you hip-hop heads, which I guess is a term of endearment for hip-hop fans, says, all you real rap fans, not you girls here to listen to Nicki Minaj's song, Starships. Not that fake stuff, but the real rap fans. Now, as you can imagine, all the Nicki Minaj fans who are there get really upset. So they go to Twitter and start saying, I can't believe DJ Rosenberg said this about Nicki Minaj. So Nicki Minaj hears about this in her trailer. You know what she does? She says, I might be the headliner for the show, but I'm not going out there. And she cancels her performance. And so it was a huge deal. And so there's this big beef between you have the major radio guy and Nicki Minaj. But the reason DJ Rosenberg was saying that is because the song doesn't really sound like a rap song. Now, if you don't know the song, you're in store. We've got it right here. Okay, here is a little part of Nicki Minaj's song that is in question. Now, if we can listen to this right now. Okay, you know the song? Luke Land's going, oh yeah, this is my song. This is my jam. Okay, that's good. That's enough. Now, if I was to ask you a question, who is more likely to sing that song, Miley Cyrus or Tupac? Who are you going to say? Miley Cyrus. And his whole argument is that doesn't sound like rap. That's a whole different genre of music. And so Nicki Minaj, when they get on the radio to as they say in hip hop, to squash the beef. Yes, I looked that up. She says, who are you to judge me? And the answer that Rosenberg said is, years before, I heard you at a small show. And I went up to you and I told you, you could be the best female rapper ever. And so I'm going to hold you to a higher standard. He said, I can't let you sell out to this other type of music when you could be the best at what you do. And we don't like people judging us, but sometimes you have to have someone who's willing to hold you to a higher standard. Jesus has this famous passage about judging in Matthew 7. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this. Matthew 7, verse 1, Jesus says, do not judge so that you may not be judged. Okay, and that's often the quote you only hear. When someone says, don't judge, Jesus said, well, Jesus said, don't judge. He says, for with the judgment you make, you will be judged. And the measure you give will be the measure you get. Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, let me take the speck out of your eye while the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to the speck to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. Okay, so Jesus says, don't judge, but first judge yourself before you can help anyone else. And then he has this next verse. He says, do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them underfoot and turn and maul you. Jesus says, don't judge, but then he goes on to say, the things that you find valuable, the things that have significance, don't give them to insignificant places. Don't put them out there for things that are valuable to be disrespected. So maybe what Jesus isn't saying is don't judge. But what he's saying, if you're going to do it in the proper way. Because what happens when you hear someone say about something you're doing and they say, I'm better than that? We do this response and we say, don't judge me. There is a completely different posture when someone says, you are better than that. One helps you, one hurts you. The kind of judging that we're about as Christian brothers and sisters is a type of statement that says, you are better than that. Because sometimes that's the only way we can be delivered from what we're stuck in. Someone saying, you're better than that. And the book of Judges obviously has judgment all in it. But when we think of judges, we typically think of the person at the front of the courtroom. But you've got to think in the book of Judges more of William Wallace. I mean, these are violent people in violent times using violent means to deliver people. But the whole book of Judges is built on rhythms and patterns. Which makes sense because in a lot of ways, people are a product of the patterns that they create and they live into. If you hear last week, we heard Chris and Stacey Hatch talk about a pattern that seems to happen in marriages where you get in this cycle. Remember what it was called, what they said? It's the box, okay? And it starts off where she says, hey, Chris, will you do something for me? And he hears this and thinks she's nagging him. And so he, in return, protests. Maybe he does the thing he was asked to do, but he does it in spite. And then, therefore, he is looked at by her as being immature. And so her response is what? Well, I'm going to nag you and tell you to do something else, which means he's going to be upset, which means he's going to... And there is this cycle that you get stuck in. People, in a lot of ways, are a product of the patterns that you're in. And so here's this pattern from the book of Judges. In Judges 3, this is the very first judge. We're actually not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I want you to see the pattern that's put out here. The Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, forgetting the Lord their God and worshiping the Baals and the Asherahs. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, against Israel. And he sold them into the hand of King, we'll just call him King. And the Israelites served that guy 8 years. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the Israelites who delivered them. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave king into his hands. And his hand prevailed over that king, so the land had rest for 40 years. Then Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. Okay, so there's this pattern. Israel, God's people, they forget the Lord, and so they do what's evil in the sight of the Lord. Therefore, God hands them over to their enemy. Therefore, Israel cries out, says, hey, deliver us, take care of us. And so God sends a judge to deliver them. The judge delivers them, and then they have peace for a generation or two generations. There's this cycle of forgetfulness, disobedience, punishment, crying out, and therefore God delivers. But one of the things that happens in this pattern is it always gets worse. Like the book of Judges, we're going to find over these 5 weeks, is it's always doing this number right here. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And the same thing happens when you get stuck in ruts in your life. You get stressed, and this is how you relieve stress, and so this is the product. Right? In his book, The Power of Habit, a writer for the New York Times, the New Yorker, Charles Duhigg, writes about how he had this pattern that happened in his life, where every afternoon around 3 o'clock, he would get up from his cubicle, walk to the cafeteria, get a cookie, and then go talk to one of his coworkers. And he said this was repeated over and over again until his wife said, Charles, you've gained some weight. You need to stop eating cookies. Which, of course, he says, don't judge me. But then he realized there was a pattern that he got stuck into. So he writes a whole book about it, and we'll talk about that more later in the series. But you get in these patterns, and the only way to break them is sometimes you need a deliverer. And so the first major judge in the book of Judges, the first major judge, the next story in Judges chapter 3. But before we get to this judge, let me just say something. This is a story that's humorous, okay? Okay, and to get humor, there's multiple types of humor. Like the most common type of humor is the equation we've all heard. Tragedy plus distance equals comedy, right? I guarantee you, if I would show a video of someone walking down the road and they just fell down, there would be a handful of people in here. I'm not looking at you, Amber and Dina, just because you're at the front, but I know both of you would laugh hysterically if you saw that, okay? That's comedy is the equation of tragedy plus distance. I got to tell you this story. Last week, Lindsay is sitting on the couch, like the part of the couch that doesn't have a back to it. I'm not going to say it's called a chaise because that's embarrassing that I know that, but it's that part. And so there's no back. And so she's gotten. She's received a gift from the hospital for being a good nurse, a stadium seat, which is a natural gift when you do a good job as a nurse. Like, here's a stadium seat. Thank you. And so she's got this stadium seat, which she got. And so she's trying to adjust it, and she's pulling and trying to pull, and the cord breaks. And so she falls backwards, completely tumbles over. And I start laughing hysterically. And she goes, Luke, if I was hurt, what would you do? And I said, I would continue to laugh and then help you. Okay, that's basic comedy. Tragedy plus distance equals comedy. But there's another type of humor that's far more subversive. If I was to ask you what a political action committee is, how many would know what that is? What if I said a super PAC? How many people would know what a super PAC is? Now, there is a research done by USA Today, or they reported this study, in which they asked Americans what a super PAC was. And do you know who told them and how they learned about a super PAC? Here you go to the slide. The Colbert Report. If you remember, a couple years ago, Stephen Colbert, who hosts a late night show on Comedy Central, saw this, what he believed to be an evil of super PACs, where these organizations could raise tons of money to influence political races. And so he went out and he started his own super PAC, and it became this humorous attack on the enemy of a super PAC. And so they did research and they found out, let's go to the next slide. If you don't have x-ray vision, let me read this for you. Sorry about that. Research found that even after controlled for general political knowledge and other facts, Colbert Report viewers had both a higher perceived knowledge and higher actual knowledge about campaign finance groups when compared to those who preferred more conventional news sources. There's another type of humor. That's not comedy, which is the tragedy plus distance, but it's the language of the man on the bottom who is trying to take down the powerful and influential. It's the kind of humor that we find in Judges chapter 3. That's what Ehud is a story of. It's a story of the little guy Israel taking down the powerful, literally. Okay, let's go to the text. Enough intro. We've got it now. Judges chapter 3. The Israelites, again, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened King Eglon of Moab against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In alliance with the Ammonites and the Amalekites, he went and defeated Israel. and they took possession of the city of palms. So the Israelites served King Eglon of Moab 18 years. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. All right, there's the cycle. They did what was evil. They got in trouble. They cried out. Okay. You have the king, and his name is Eglon. Now, if you've read the Old Testament enough, or at least you showed up in enough sermons in which we talked about the Old Testament here, you realize that there's always something to names. They always seem to make names have a significant point. Now, if you've never looked up the word Eglon, let me tell you what that means. The word Eglon is a literal translation of the word calf. Calf. Okay. Now, in the Old Testament, if you were reading the Old Testament and you heard about a calf, what do you think of? Calf is what's sacrificed. Okay. So keep that in the back of your head. You have a guy named Eglon who is calf. And then your second character is Ehud. He is a, what does it say about him? He's left-handed, but he's from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin means of the right hand. All right? Now, some translators look at that word left hand as actually meaning right hand restricted. So he's from a family known as the right-handed people, and possibly his right hand is restricted. Now, today, if you hear someone who's left-handed, is there any negative connotation? No. What does President Bush Sr., President Clinton, President Obama, Senator McCain, what do all these people have in common? They're left-handed. A lot of creative people, you and me, are left-handed. They say there's 10% of Americans that are left-handed. And if you can overcome being left-handed in a right-handed world, it means you're a great leader. Or at least that's what I tell myself. But in those days, it was something that people looked down upon. And so this guy can't use his right hand. He's from the tribe of right-handed people. And he's left-handed. This is someone who is looked down upon because of his weakness. This is possibly a handicap that he has. Okay. The Israelites sent tribute by him, by Ehud, to King Eglon, King Calf of Moab. Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length. And he fastened it on his right thigh under his clothes. If you're left-handed, where do you need your sword to be? Right here. Okay. If you're right-handed, where's your sword going to be? Right there. Okay. Then he presented the tribute to King Eglon of Moab. Now, King Eglon was a very fat man. What kind of calf are you supposed to sacrifice? A fattened calf. Okay, there we go. When Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent the people who carried the tribute on their way. But he turned back at the sculptured stones near Gilgal and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." So the king said, "Silence," and all his attendants went out from his presence. Why do you think his attendants didn't care to look at Ehud? Possibly because he was a handicapped person, and there's no real reason to think that kind of person would be a physical threat to the massive king. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in the cool roof chamber and said, "I have a message from God for you." So he rose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into Eglon's belly. The hilt also went in after the blade. The fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the dirt came out. The guy who's compiling the story, or girl, clearly has the fear that his dad is going to eventually show up while the story is being told. And so he doesn't say what the dirt means. So he just says, "The dirt came out." And then he goes into great detail about what happens to the sword. And you go, why do you have to put all the detail about the fat covering over the sword and all that stuff? And the one logical answer is because he really wanted to make sure the point sunk in. Okay. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule, closed the doors of the roof chamber on him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came. When they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, he must be relieving himself in the cool chamber. So they waited, not until he would be embarrassed, but till they were embarrassed. They were thinking, maybe he's playing Angry Birds and his feet are numb now, but he's enjoying the game. I don't know. When he still did not open the doors of the roof chambers, They took the key and opened them. There was their Lord lying dead on the floor. He had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the sculpture stones and escaped to Sarah. When he arrived, he sounded the trump in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hill country. Having him at their head, he said to them, "Follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand." So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan after the Moabites and allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they killed about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied, maybe not like Ehud. No one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. For two generations, there's peace because of Ehud. So when you read stories like this, the question you always have to ask is, what does it say about God? Obviously, this is a bloody story and a very violent story that Jesus' teaching about turning the other cheek really calls into question. Is this really how God's people are supposed to act? But back then, this is God in a very bloody, brutal time. This is how God is acting. And what does it say about God? What does it say about God that he would pick Ehud, the right-handed, restricted person of the Benjaminite? First of all, can you imagine what it'd be like for Ehud? Going back to like, your name is, you are from the right-handed people and you can't use your right hand. Like I had this guy, I think I've told you about him before, but there's a guy on my high school wrestling team and his name was Matt Burns. Matt Burns. Like he would have had failed in life if he wasn't on the wrestling team getting Matt Burns. Like there's another guy on the wrestling team who also had a sweet name. His name was Dusty Lane. And he would have failed in life if he didn't live in the country on some back roads that was actually really more of a dusty lane than a dirt road. And that's what he lived on. Like he would have failed. Like if you live in West Texas and your name is Colt McCoy, like you have to be great at something. Either that or you're going to be ridiculed, right? Ehud, you are from the right-handed people and you can't use your right hand. If he's anything like most of us, can you imagine how he always lives in shame of that? How when people bring up the conversation about, hey, what kind of glove do you want? You want a left-handed, right? He always kind of cowers away. Or whenever the conversation is going towards, hey, do you bat right-handed or left-handed? He's always trying to cower away from that kind of stuff. Like we do. When we have things like that. Maybe we're embarrassed of. We're saying, well, you know, I wish I had more of this. And I wish I had more in my bank account. I wish, I had this part of my life taken care of. I wish I had this. I wish I was like more of them. And we always have this sort of constant embarrassment of shame of what we couldn't be. If he's anything like us, then he's always hiding from it. But maybe that's the very thing that God uses you for. Can I introduce you to one more person? You guys, I'm going to introduce you to another one. I'm not going to say this is the last one today, but this is the next one I'm going to introduce you. This is a guy right here. Some of you might know. You might have seen him on movies. His name, he goes by the name Tiny, because he's huge, which is funny, I guess. His name is Tiny Lister. He's like 6'5", 300 pounds, and when he graduated college, he was a Division II shot putting national champion. But he just finished college, didn't know what he was going to do. And an agent found him in California and said, I could turn you into a movie star. And so some of you have probably seen this guy in movies, probably not too many romantic comedies, but he's in other kind of movies. And the reason the agent said, I could put you in movies is the very thing you've probably noticed about him. You've probably noticed his right eye has some discoloration. See, when Tiny was born, his right eye was blind. And it's been that way his entire life. And the agent looked at him and said, there are plenty of big people, there are plenty of tall people, but you have a look that is intimidating because of your handicap, and that's the very thing that can make you a star. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, he's talking about weaknesses, and he says this, but he, God, said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. So I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities for the sake of Christ. For whenever I am weak, then I'm strong. There's this weird power that works in the kingdom of heaven where it's not your skills and your abilities and your talents, but it's actually your weaknesses that God uses. I talked about the hatches already today, but if you were here last week, maybe you were impressed with the thing I was most impressed with. You have this couple to get up and talk about marriage. And there's a temptation when you get up and talk about marriage, to talk about all the good things in your marriage, of all the things you do right for your spouse. Or maybe you can move to kind of like the second level of like bragging, where it's not you bragging about yourself, but you brag about your spouse, and then your spouse brags about you, right? You can do that. Anyone can do that. But they started their talk and said, we've gone to counseling. We're not perfect. We needed help. And that's the reason I think they can help so many people, is because they're willing to say, we're not perfect. Because somehow in the kingdom of heaven, God's power is made perfect in your weakness and the things that you hide from. The thing that you say, I wish no one would bring up to me, that might be the very thing that God uses. The very thing you've been afraid of and shameful of for so long is the very thing God wants to use you for, which is a whole different way of understanding power and strength and weakness, which requires a commitment to being honest about things that aren't really easy to be honest about, because it's easy for us to hide from those things. But sometimes what we need is someone who can just speak truth where everyone else is speaking lies. Like this. Here's a best man's speech that is a great example of someone speaking truth when everyone else might not
be. The most beautiful woman in the world, my wife.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, please show your appreciation for the best man.
The most beautiful woman in the world? I don't think so, mate. I mean, honestly. I'm not being nasty. It's not nasty to say someone isn't the most beautiful woman in the world, and she looks, you know, fine. Good, very presentable, but better than ever. Just not better than everyone. What? Sorry, Jane, you've not been thinking you're the most beautiful woman in the world, have you? Why would you think that? What? Have you all gone mad? She is not the most beautiful woman in the world. She's top half, probably, but that's largely because of her relative youth. That's not rude. There's no one in this room who's anywhere near that attractive. I mean, one of the bridesmaids is pretty tasty, but not, you know, world class.
You're not so hot yourself.
I never said I was. He said that she was the most beautiful woman in the world. And I just wouldn't want their life together to kick off with a lie.
To me, she's the most beautiful woman in the world, so just get on with it.
Okay, to you. Right, but you know she's not really, deep down. You're not mad. You just fancy her more than she is objectively attractive. Which is good.
Okay. Tragedy plus distance is comedy. All right, we get that. So there's a limit. Like, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to have that kind of commitment to truth. That's the thing that makes people close their ears. But there is this commitment that we must make towards reality if you want to be a healthy person. If you want to be well-adjusted, if you want to be someone who is living up to who God created you to be, there has to be this radical commitment to honesty, which means you avoid fantasy at all costs. And sometimes that means you being willing to listen to when someone says you're better than that. Maybe it's a counselor, maybe it's a friend. Maybe you have this rare moment of self-awareness that shows you this thing that is a weakness. And you have to make a radical commitment to live out of that. Because that thing which you might be afraid of, embarrassed of, and hiding from might be the very thing that opens you up to the life that God intended for you. Let me introduce you to one last. This is seriously the last person. Okay, this right here is a basketball legend, a basketball genius that I want you to meet. It's not him, it's that guy right there, okay? That's the basketball legend I wanted to introduce you. The guy on the right, not so much. Okay, that guy, Vivek Ranadive, okay? Not many people have probably heard of this guy. His daughter decides she wants to play in a basketball team. And so he said, I'll coach. But the problem is he grew up in India, and he's this programming guy, and he had never touched a basketball, ever. And his daughter wants to play basketball, and he has to be the coach. And so he goes and he watches the team practice that has been given to him. Not many of them can dribble. Not many of them can shoot. They're not that talented. They're not that good. You might be saying, did he look at the Miami Heat without LeBron James? Maybe so. Okay. Nothing? I thought it was going to be a little better than that was. I really like that joke. Okay. Thank you, Aaron. Okay. And so he looks at this team and they go, you can't really dribble, you can't really shoot, you're not that talented, you're not that experienced, so what am I going to do? And so he does what a good programmer does. He creates this algorithm, which I don't even understand, and he comes up to the conclusion that all they're going to do in practice is work on full court defense. And when it comes to the game, all they've drilled is full court defense, and they're going to get in people's faces and do this the whole time. And the only offense they're going to have is when the ball is turned over and they're going to have easy layups. This team has no talent, few people can shoot, few people can dribble, not much experience. That's all they do. And they go to the state championship game because they had this crazy, upside-down, unorthodox way of playing because they played out of their weakness. And the end of the story is Vivek Ranadat fell in love with basketball and ended up buying the Sacramento Kings. Because, like I said, he's a pretty good programmer, so he's doing well. He loves basketball now. It's a great end of the story. But when you learn to have this radical commitment to reality and honesty, and you understand who you are and what your strengths and what your weaknesses are, you learn how to play out of that. And it might be your embarrassment that you can't do this for your family and your kids, but you learn to say the very thing that Paul said in that moment. He said, my grace is sufficient for you. That's the voice you heard from God saying out of his weakness. And when you're embarrassed of your past and you say, this is my weakness and I don't want to deal with it, you learn to hear that same refrain that his power is made perfect in my weakness. And when you can't live up and you can't achieve and you can't accomplish all the things you want to, you learn to have that same refrain that his grace is still sufficient for me. Now, like I said, this story of is kind of gruesome. If it was made into a movie, it would definitely be R-rated for obvious reasons. And one of those is because Eglon, this fattened calf, is killed in a very brutal fashion. And so there's a really kind of crude metaphor that's kind of woven in there that when Ehud learned to live out of his weakness, his action was turned into an act of worship. A fattened calf is a thing of worship for a Jewish person. And a far less gross way, when we learn to live out of our weaknesses, it becomes an act of worship to God too. When you learn to say, his power is made perfect in my weakness, and out of this place that I want to hide from, that I'm going to let God use, somehow God is glorified in that. So may we learn to have that radical willingness to hear someone say, you are better than that. Let's pray. God, you are good. And we know you are good because you work not out of the strong and the mighty, but you have shamed the strong and the mighty of the world by using what is weak. You have used David to conquer Goliath. You have used Israel to be a light into the world, this little tiny nation. And you have used fishermen, uneducated fishermen, to change the world. And you use people like me. We all are imperfect and we all have weaknesses. But help us to hear you saying that we are better than to live this shameful existence in which we hide from our weaknesses. But let us learn to live out of your strength, not out of our own. And let us find hope in you, because you are good. Praise in Christ's name. Amen.